Happy Juneteenth. The JX crew takes the holiday, offering an interview from 2021.
The days when people spend their lives within a few miles of their birthplaces are long gone, but most of us can at least talk about a place where we got started, a place where we are from. For our guest this hour, it wasn't easy. Louis Chudas O'Kee was born in a country that only existed for a few years. That's Biafra. He was taken very young to Jamaica while he waited for his mother to come for him. He was still quite young when she sent for him to join him in the United States. The details appear in a newly published memoir from Louis called Floating in a Most Peculiar Way. Louis Chudas O'Kee directs the African American Studies program at Boston University, is a professor of English there, and is also the editor-in-chief of The Black Scholar, the Journal of African American Studies. He's the author of two previous books. Louis, thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you so much for having me. Very happy to be here.
It's truly a pleasure. You don't just study and write about the African diaspora. You lived it. I mean, let's talk about Biafra. This is going to ring a bell for a couple of generations, and it's going to mean absolutely nothing to younger ones. How long has Biafra been gone?
How long has Biafra been gone, you said?
Yes.
Well, Biafra lasted from 1967 to 1969, technically. It didn't last very long, but the impact that it had culturally and intellectually, but more importantly, spiritually on the country that is Nigeria and the many people that suffered and died due to what was tantamount to genocide, the impact continues. Nigeria is still scarred by Biafra, and there's still a new Biafra movement that's still out there in Nigeria. But one of the things I wanted to do in these stories that comprise my memoir is tell the story of why Biafra matters to us in the United States, because in many ways, Biafra was the engine of a specific kind of diaspora. It drove a lot of Igbo people out of Nigeria to the United States, to Europe, and to different parts of the world. So Biafra was also considered the first televised African war, because it was the first war that emerged in the wake of mass media in Africa. And people also described it as the first black-on-black genocide, at least in the 20th century. So there's a lot to Biafra that really sets the pattern for contemporary politics in Africa, but also in the world, absolutely. Because also, part of the problem with Biafra was that it was northern fundamentalist, Islamic fundamentalist, attacking and massacring by the hundreds of thousands Christian Igbos from the East. And that pattern has continued in contemporary Africa, particularly in Nigeria.
I want to make sure that the audience understands what we're talking about. You're saying Igbo people, Igbo, I-G-B-O, not evil people.
Thank you, yes. Igbo people, I-G-B-O. That's the ethnic group that largely suffered through the genocide of the Biafra War. It's also the ethnic group that my family comes from.
Now, how involved were your parents in the declaration of Biafran independence from Nigeria?
Well, that's actually one of the things that's so crucial to my own experience and the writing of the book. My godfather was the leader of the Biafra secession. He was the head of state of the nation Biafra, Odumegwu Ojukwu, who I write about in the book. He's very much a part of the narrative. And my father was one of his right-hand men. And my mother, a Jamaican woman, who met him when he was at Sandhurst Military in College in England, married him, and 6 weeks later, she's in independence-era Nigeria, and 3 years after that, the genocide begins. So my family was very involved in the Biafra War at the very highest levels.
And in fact, there are people who say that Biafra did not survive long after your father was killed.
Yes. Father is wrapped in lots of legends. But it is true that he was killed in 1968, and Biafra didn't last much longer after that. Ojukwu eventually went into exile, and my mother and I became refugees in Gabon, which is a neighboring country where we were smuggled out and survived the collapse of Biafra.
Well, so your earliest memories, though, are of Jamaica. I mean, who did you live with there?
Well, that's interesting because migrating from Nigeria or Biafra to Gabon We were in Gabon for a couple of years, but my mother worked her way through Gabon, and we got our way back to Jamaica. My mother, having been born in Jamaica, she had family there, and we were there together for a while before she moved to the United States. And while she was in the United States working to get a job and, you know, establish stability so that she could send for me, I was adopted by a Seventh-day Adventist family.
And that was a big auntie and uncle daddy. So did all the kids there, were they all basically in transit from one place to another?
Absolutely. It was just this sort of waiting room where some of the kids, their parents were in Canada, some were in the United States, some were in the UK, and we were just all there. Some of us made it. Our parents sent for us. Some of us didn't make it, and our parents didn't send for us, so we were sent back to the country to live with our grandparents, or some I don't know where they went. But that house is an interesting back-and-forth space of children full of great aspirations to travel, but it was never clear if we would ever actually get there.
Well, and it wasn't just the kids traveling. It was also people traveling to see you. You describe a parade of African men coming to see you. How much sense could you make of what they wanted from you?
Well, this, you know, back to your previous comment about my earliest memories being in Jamaica. Of course, when we got to Jamaica, I was too young to remember West Africa or Gabon. Barely remembered it. But what I do remember was in the earliest days of my time in Jamaica, and I was told this when I grew up all the time, that Igbo ex-soldiers would just show up in Jamaica trying to find the son of the first son.
And that was you. You were the first son of the first son.
First son of the first son. But here I am, a kid, being, in a sense, worshipped by these soldiers, telling me how great my father and my godfather were, and how, you know, we were going to be free. We didn't lose the war. Don't worry.
Lewis, it's not just the title, but all the chapter titles are David Bowie songs as well. Tell us the meaning.
Well, in terms of family legend, apparently when I was in the refugee camps in Gabon, one of the aid workers sang the song Space Oddity regularly. Apparently I took to it as a child, and my mother began singing it to me and soothing me to sleep with it through the refugee camps and also through my childhood in Jamaica when we migrated there. This is what I have been told. But the way I can confirm that it's likely to be true is that I just, from the earliest memories I have of music and sound and culture, I was obsessed with this voice when I would hear it on the radio that turned out to be this person named David Bowie. I didn't know it was that person. I just knew the voice. And I spent much of my time in Jamaica on the radio, nights, the daytimes. And then I discovered it early in my arrival in the United States, and that was just a very important moment for me to describe, to define who this person was and what this person meant to me. And clearly there's a lot of poetic and metaphoric connections to this alien who refuses to come down, this creative figure who people can't figure out who and what he is, but he's unapologetic about it. That makes sense to me now, but as a child, it was just amazing, weird music that I wanted to know more about. And as I dug more into this person named David Bowie, he seemed very connected to something that I was already also obsessed with from when I was a child in Jamaica, and that is science fiction.
There's a lot of different connections there then, but yeah, the whole it certainly works as a metaphor, the idea of floating in a peculiar way, not really having your feet completely on the ground. But they did get there eventually. Lewis Chudasokyi is the guest in an interview from 2021 talking about his memoir of African diaspora, Floating in a Most Peculiar Way. Since that verse from David Bowie's Space Oddity is so central to Lewis's life and his book, let's hear the song before we get back to the conversation.
Ground control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom. Take your protein pills and put your helmet on. Ground control to Major Tom.
7, 6.
Commencing countdown, engines on.
3, 2.
Check ignition and may God's love be with you. This is ground control to Major Tom. You've really made the grade, and the papers want to know whose shirt you wear. Now it's time to leave the capsule if you dare. This is Major Tom to ground control. I'm stepping through the door, and I'm floating in a most peculiar way, and the stars look very different today. For here am I sitting in a tin can.
David Bowie's Space Oddity from 1969. At the time of the song's release, what was to be a war of independence was raging in Biafra. 6 months later, it was over, with the rebellion crushed and Louis Chudasoki and his mother becoming refugees. His story of making his way into a new life in Jamaica and then the United States is told in Louis's book, Floating in a Most Peculiar Way. That's the interview we're presenting on this Juneteenth. We'll get back to our conversation on the Jefferson Exchange here on JPR in just a bit. Thank you. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on JPR, I'm Jeffrey Riley. We're spending Juneteenth re-listening to the story of Louis Chutes O'Keeffe, born in what was briefly called Biafra, then shipped off to the Caribbean when Biafra lost its war for independence from Nigeria. Louis's memoir is floating in a most peculiar way.
You describe in Jamaica living on an island and in a household that had largely negative associations with the idea of Africa. Why?
Well, that's the interesting thing. This goes back to my mother's generation, too, though, because my mother left Jamaica in the 1950s as one of those Caribbean immigrants who were invited to help the motherland heal after World War II. And so she arrives in England in the 1950s, convinced that she's a British citizen and a member of the empire, only to discover this thing called incredibly vicious racism. Right? But she had been told, her generation had been told that, you know, Africans are beneath you, they are pagans, they live in trees, they're not Christian. And she, despite all of that, falls in love with an African. And her family is livid. And then she goes to Africa and disappears into the chaos of war and refugee status, which confirms to the Caribbean people, yes, that's why you shouldn't marry or have anything to do with Africans. It's all chaos. Of course, the Africans have their own problematic associations with West Indian people, people who were slaves, right? And so my mother, I think, really pioneered this kind of black cross-cultural tension thing. And I grew up in Jamaica, in a country that was discovering its own black pride through reggae and Rastafarianism. But the Africa that they were celebrating was not the Africa we came from. We came from an Africa that was brutal. There was a lot of, we came to a genocide. Mm-hmm. And so that was not welcome as a representation of Africa in the Caribbean at the time when we arrived. So I grew up, on the one hand, being told by visiting Igbo soldiers that you are the, you know, the sign of the future, the glorious possibilities of our struggle, but around Jamaican people, not all of them, but many of them, convinced that, well, you're African, you're clearly going to hell, you are inferior, you're from the bush, and you're not one of us. And so a lot of my thinking about race and culture is formed in that specific crucible, right, of multiple blacknesses that may or may not interact with each other in a comfortable way.
Sure, and urging, you know, not to be like that, because that's just not the right way to be, which is not helpful for a young child, particularly one without his parents. So here you are living in the household of Big Auntie and Uncle Daddy, with a bunch of other kids who believe they're going to be ending up in the United States or Canada or elsewhere. But this is where you developed a real hunger for reading. And how did Big Auntie and Uncle Daddy take to that?
Well, as I described in the book, there's different kinds of reading. There were books that were for display as a good working class, lower middle class, with great aspirations, Jamaican family, you had all of the right books on the shelves, but they weren't to be read. They were to signify to people that you were aspiring in the right cultural direction. And so I couldn't really read those books unless I, you know, smuggled them out, read them, or got in trouble, and I would be punished for that. So that kind of reading was there, but that was more dangerous. Then there was church reading. We were welcome, encouraged to read all the stuff that came from the church publications, the Seventh-day Adventist Church. But then there were kids who would smuggle comic books and science fiction novels from the markets on the street, you know, down the end of the road. And I read those, and those were just so crucial to who I was at the time. It was escape, it was possibility, and it was these science fiction adventure novels were full of the kind of narratives that seemed to be consistent with what Igbo soldiers were saying to me when they came to visit, at least when they initially came to visit. Eventually, they stopped coming, right? But science fiction and adventure novels were about, you know, a prince who had a great destiny and had to go and liberate his people. And so all of those cliches made more sense to me than being treated as an African in Jamaica, right, or someone who was not really a member of this family. And so science fiction really, really was crucial to my imagination then.
So it sounds like the Igbo soldiers from Africa were giving you essentially the exact opposite story of what Big Auntie and Uncle Daddy were telling you.
Yes, exactly. So it's, again, the memoir is a memoir of being constantly in spaces where you are told different things that are, in fact, confident of themselves as black things, but they don't actually communicate with each other and don't actually correspond. So Big Auntie and Uncle Daddy were very clear on their Jamaican sense of pride. The Igbo soldiers had their sense of pride, but the Igbo soldiers would always remind me, these are not your people. Right? You are not one of these people. And of course, those people were saying, well, you're not one of us either. Right? But of course, as a young child, you're not really looking for home. You just want to not be beat up.
Yeah. And there was a fair amount of that in that household, wasn't there?
Exactly. It was a tough place to grow up. And my mother and I would argue back and forth. You know, she would argue that I exaggerated the trauma, and I would say that she diminished it in order to, you know, not deal with the responsibility and guilt of it, you know.
Louis Chuta Soke is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He directs the African American Studies Program at Boston University. As a professor of English there, is editor-in-chief of The Black Scholar, the Journal of African American Studies. He's been writing extensively on the African diaspora, of which he is a part. His parents were instrumental in the Declaration of Independence in Biafra in eastern Nigeria and fought in a war there that ended unsuccessfully for Biafra, getting rolled back into Nigeria. They had to flee. His father was dead by this time. His mother had to flee with Lewis. He ended up in Jamaica and finally in the United States. He tells the story in Floating in a Most Peculiar Way, a memoir. So it wasn't just that you were a reader, you were a writer as well early, and you prepared a speech for the day of your departure from the house in Montego Bay with Big Auntie and Uncle Daddy. Why didn't you get to deliver that speech, Lewis?
You mean the speech, my departure speech, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah, like most of the kids, we, you know, a lot of our, let's call it capital, a lot of our capital in the house depended on not just what money parents would send back to the household, you know, for Big Auntie and Uncle Daddy to take for our upkeep. It was also based on which country we were going to. And sometimes England was cooler, and sometimes Toronto or Canada was cooler, and sometimes the United States was cooler. So we spent a lot of time imagining what our lives would be like in these other countries, and I write quite a bit about that. We also prepared our departures because we knew we were going to leave. And so I did have a speech, as some of my peers did, right? Well, they had certain rituals that they would prepare, knowing that this day would come, and then they would be able to declare to the whole household, you know, I'm out of here, or, you know, or you treated me so badly, I'm going to go away and become famous now, or things like that. But of course, I never got a chance to do that because I never knew that I was leaving. The day that I was leaving the country, no one told me I was leaving. They just took me to the airport and put me on a plane. Next thing I know, I was off to D.C. And so I felt cheated of my melodramatic moment.
I felt that with you as I read the book. Yeah, it's like, hey, wait a minute, my speech. So you get to America, you're left alone in your mother's D.C. apartment for long periods of time with lots to read. What did you learn from what you were able to read in Mom's apartment?
Well, the thing is, I at the time, I didn't know the word hoarder. But my mother was beginning to develop what we now call hoarding tendencies. But one of the things that I began to notice around me was that she kept everything. Books, not so much books, magazines, newspapers, articles, things pertaining to Biafra, photos of the genocide, newspapers with my godfather on the cover, images of the war, images of Jamaica in the 1950s and 60s, photos of her in London. So the apartment, was tiny, very tiny studio apartment that was just dense with so much stuff. And while I'm stuck in here until I'm able to go to school, that's what I read. And a lot of what I read was about Biafra. It was about the war, about these men who were supposedly my uncles and my father, and saw pictures of my mom looking so glamorous and their wedding and swords and motorcades and things like that. It was quite remarkable to dig into it. But at the same time, I discovered that I couldn't ask her much about it because she didn't want to talk about it.
Mm-hmm. And how old were you by this point when you got to the United States?
I'm in the United States at around 9 or 10.
Uh-huh. Okay, so still pretty young, but a lot to absorb for somebody at that age. And so you got a lot of information about the past that summer. You hadn't gone to school yet. I mean, but as you got outside the house, what observations did you make about society in America and how it broke on skin color?
Well, that's the thing. You know, you arrive in this place already, your mind is already sort of defined by the experience of being an African in Jamaica or also being from a country that was, violently killed is what my mother said. My mother always said that they killed our country or they starved our country. So you're coming from that and you land in the United States, and I come to the United States having this romantic association of African Americans because in Jamaica at that time, everybody's, they've got the afros, and everyone is watching African American movies or TV shows or listening to African American music. And so African Americans just signify a kind of power and cool and freedom. And so that's what we young boys in Jamaica in the house, when we were talking about our futures, we were all African American. We would go to America and become Americans. And certainly I would, and my other cousins who were headed to the United States. And you come to the United States, and one of the first things you're told by your very insular Caribbean and African immigrant community is, don't affiliate with them. They are not like you. You will be mistaken for them. And if you are mistaken for them, that's when you will get into trouble. And so you realize that a big part of the black immigrant experience, at least for me, was not just dealing with white racism or white supremacy or things like that. It's also being told not to assimilate into that other America. And that other America is African-American culture. So you have to balance these things, not just white supremacy and African-American culture, but also the prejudices of your immigrant community.
So, as you pointed out already, not just blackness singular, but blacknesses plural.
Which may or may not, which is a common theme in my work, which may or may not correspond and blend, right? Because at the same time, too, I'm discovering African-Americans who are not particularly welcoming to us as black immigrants because of so many things, right? Mm. So that's the crucible of assimilation for not just black immigrants, but a lot of immigrants of color.
So there are two amazing stories you tell back-to-back in the book. The first is being called the N-word by a kid in school, and the second is the poem you wrote about Martin Luther King. How did you react to the kid calling you by the N-word?
Well, at the time, I'd never really heard it before. I'm 9 or 10, fairly fresh from Jamaica, right, in a Seventh-day Adventist household where we were not allowed to listen to reggae music or, the R&B music, like the Jackson 5 and stuff like that, that the older cousins listened to. They had to smuggle that into the house, too, because it was a very religious household. So hearing that word, I didn't actually know what it meant or how I'm supposed to respond to it. I just knew that the kid who called me that, right, had a particular look of anger on his face that, as an immigrant who is under the assumption that, well, I'm new to this place, everything I do is probably my fault. Please let me know what I've done wrong so I can be better next time. So I then bring it up to my family, and it just triggers this incredible response. The West Indian side of the family have different responses to what the N-word means. And the West African part of the family has an entirely different response to what the N-word means, right? There were those for whom it means, look, it means that you, they blame my mother, you are not teaching him to stand out enough. He must have his accent stronger. He must never be mistaken for them. The N-word is not the problem for these members of my family. He's mistaken for people who should be called the N-word. And those people were African-Americans. And so you get that message. But then you get the other message from other aunties from other parts of the diaspora saying, don't worry. If they're calling you, they call you that, but it's because they don't know who you are, and that's a safe place to hide. you can still get what you want out of this country if they call you that. It's because they think you're someone else, and it's great to hide in that space. So, and my mother, of course, doesn't really know what to communicate. So, as with most children, you blame your mother.
Ah, of course.
Much more coming from Louis Chudasoki, the author of Floating in a Most Peculiar Way. We're back on the Jefferson Exchange after a break. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. We're spending Juneteenth re-listening to the story of Louis Chudasoki, born in what was briefly called Biafra, then shipped off to the Caribbean when Biafra lost its war for independence from Nigeria. Louis's memoir is Floating in a Most Peculiar Way. We pick up the story at a pivotal moment in Louis's childhood in the United States.
So to pick up the story by getting called the N-word by a white kid in school in the District of Columbia, so even your family wasn't sure what the response should be. How did you come back to this kid?
Well, the family were all clear that, even though they had different responses, they were all clear that a mistake was made. And it was a failure on the part of my mother and myself to not distinguish ourselves enough from African Americans. And so for them, the N-word was about African-Americans and their relationship to white people. It was not about us. And so this begins a kind of new pattern of training in America with my immigrant community, how to be a different kind of black person in the United States in such a way as to maintain difference from not just African-Americans, but white perceptions of you as an I go back to because my aunts give me this whole statement that they made me memorize. And, you know, I documented in the book, you know, it begins with, I am not a slave. My father was not a slave, et cetera, et cetera. It's a whole little statement that we, not just me, but my cousins had to memorize for whenever we were called the N-word, right? Mm-hmm. And we were told to emphasize our accents whenever we made that statement, right? Or my cousins who were from Gabon were told, first say it in French so that they know you speak French.
Wow. There's just layers
And so I go back to the kid, ready, right? Ready for him. Of course the kid doesn't remember me. He's just a stupid kid. The kid. So I start bumping into him in the hallway trying to get him to call me the N-word. Because I've been prepared.
Yeah.
And finally, he does. And I'm just elated because now I get to display myself as I've been trained by my family. And I recite the thing, and the kid starts crying like, you know, he's like a 9-year-old.
Yeah.
And the teachers come, and they grab me. And at that point, I began to realize that I'm actually significantly larger than this kid. Yeah. And the teachers are just basically seeing this larger black kid dealing with this young white kid. And I begin to realize, okay, there's some things going on right here that I didn't expect, right? And at that point, I'm pretty convinced, as I say in the book, I was convinced that I was going to get deported, but I wasn't sure which country they would send me back to.
Oh, wow.
And so, yeah, there's more detail about how that plays out, but at that moment, I start to understand or begin to learn that there's more to the skin color thing in this country than I thought. Because it was there in Jamaica, but it was an entirely different dispensation because there weren't really that many white people around at all.
Mm-hmm. But then this is right after this incident in the book with you getting called the N-word by the kid who you make cry because you had a response to him later on. But then it's quickly followed by the story about a poem you wrote about Martin Luther King Jr. and a black teacher, one of the few in the school you report, got livid. Why?
Yeah, well, this teacher was so angered because for her, Martin Luther King, and she said this, didn't represent Africans who were embarrassing good black people by killing each other in Biafra. So this was an African-American teacher who had real hostilities to immigrants, but also how what was going on in Africa through Biafra and Uganda and in that world right after independence, right after native ships, et cetera. She just saw those African struggles as embarrassing to the attempt to establish a powerful, positive African-American self-image in the United States. And so she came up and she took the poem from me and said publicly, Martin Luther King didn't die for you people. He died for us, right? Mm. And so that becomes another defining understanding of race and my position in these multiple blacknesses at a very early age upon my arrival in the United States. Again, I'm a kid. I don't fully understand what may have gone on in this person's perspective to feed these points of view. I understand now part of the challenge of writing. It would be easy for me as a scholar to editorialize or to theorize or to contextualize, but that wouldn't clarify or present in the powerful way I needed to what it's like to feel and hear these things as a kid.
Yeah, that's the amazing part, is that you more or less held it together, but certainly some bumps along the way. So from D.C., you ended up moving to the Los Angeles area. And here again, the divisions within divisions, that blackness in L.A., in order for you to survive, was different from blackness among your extended family in D.C. So what did you do to fit in?
When we arrived in Los Angeles, we moved to an area that was gang territory, So I arrived in the Crenshaw, Inglewood, bordering on the South Central LA area. And so the gang warfare was, as a kid, more important than anything else, because I'm now walking to school. I'm now out on the street. I'm now engaging my neighbors in a way that I didn't. In D.C., we were much more tight-knit. The community was much more tight-knit. In L.A., it's very spread out. You could not avoid or segregate yourself from, other types of people. And so you immediately get caught up in the crossfire. But, of course, as a young man, it's kind of romantic.
Huh.
It's about loyalty. It's about territory. It's about masculinity. It's about, you hope, getting sex, right? as well as respect. It's all those young male things.
Right.
And so that's how that's how L.A. immediately appeared to me. But it was also really, really dangerous because, as I mentioned in the book, we were at that moment when guns began to enter into, our universe little by little. First as a rumor, but then the actuality of guns supplanting knives or fists became much more a concern. And then once I started, began to shape and reshape my understanding of race and masculinity, certainly.
So you came across as a tough guy and weren't showing what a good student you were capable of being. So talk about the response that one teacher had to your high standardized test scores.
Yeah, that... I was so busy trying to be a tough guy, which is back to your question of fitting in,
mm-hmm.
right? I was so busy trying to be a tough guy and hiding the fact that I read books and science fiction. Because when I first got there, I'm in America, I'm in LA, I wanted everybody to see that I read books. But I discovered quite early that was not a good idea, right? And of course, I'm proud, I'm listening to David Bowie and all this weird music. That also was not a good idea. Right. And so, play the tough guy, and I started lifting weights, and I had a cousin who was actually a gangbanger, and I learned things from him and his friends, about how to carry yourself and present yourself. And I didn't realize that I had actually, that I was actually in remedial education. I was so busy trying to fit in with the cool guys that I thought, okay, I'm in here with all the kids who are tough and scary and it's cool to be it's cool to be in these special classes. It wasn't until I took an exam in one of these classes that struck me, felt the need to call my mother and let her know that you do know this is remedial education. Your son is in remedial education, which of course almost destroyed my mother.
Yeah,
she was so busy doing multiple jobs, she didn't know, and neither did I because I was so busy, trying to fit in a certain way. And because of that teacher and a couple of other teachers, things began to change a little bit.
Well, there was one teacher in particular, and honestly, this part of the book almost made me cry. This was a white gym teacher who treated you like a thug in public, but by then she knew a hidden truth about you. What was that truth, and why did she treat you like you were a thug?
She found out that I was actually trying to write science fiction novels, because one day I had lost a manuscript and, absolutely terrified, ran around the school trying to find it, because I didn't want anyone to know that here's this guy who's trying to be a tough guy, writing stories about, you know, dwarves and aliens and lasers and et cetera. So it turned out, you know, that she found it. And not only did she continue to treat me like a thug in public, in private, she was giving me science fiction novels from her own collection. And I remember just, and I narrated in the book in such a way as to say that this was just one of those strange moments where, to anyone outside, she was being a racist. She was treating me like, you know, black thug kid who has, you know, who must be treated with hostility and suspicion. But she was doing it, she realized that that's how I needed to be seen in that immediate community, and was trying to be seen that way in order to survive it. But in private, she treated me in a completely different way. And that, too, gave me a much more complicated or nuanced understanding of how race and racism worked. Now, the argument is not that she is or isn't racist. I'm not interested in that in the book. I'm just interested in, this person showed me a kindness that would not have been seen as such by others.
Yeah, it was. The way you portray it is—it's amazing to think what this woman did in helping you in several ways. One of which was to maintain an image in front of kids your age.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, Lewis, the popular phrase in our time is finding your tribe, and if there's a better one, please feel free to substitute. But when or where did you feel like you had?
It's interesting because I don't really think of the book, and I, just because I wrote it doesn't mean I have any final authority on how it's analyzed, right? The book is less about trying to find a tribe than it is about just surviving in whatever place you're in. Mm-hmm. What are the rules and the laws of this community, right? What are the rules of this blackness? Because you're not going to escape blackness. What are the rules? Because I also want to point out that, you know, Biafra ended, I said 69 before, it ended in 70, the beginning of 1970. But that's also a period of a lot of anti-colonial struggle and politics throughout the black world. So even though my family may have been hostile and suspicious of African Americans, there were also many of them anti-colonial revolutionary fighters. They were resistant to British domination. They were critical of white supremacy and white racism. So, you know, these tribes were all critical of racism and were anti-racist, but that didn't mean that they got along with each other in an easy way, right? So finding tribes for me was never going to be easy, and I don't know that I was actually ever trying. I just wanted to just know how to get through this particular period of life. The only tribe I ever found is in the books and in the music. In Bowie and the music that Bowie led to, and in the books that I read that gave me vision and possibility and creativity. And so that tribe led me to an academic literary career. And so that's the closest to community I ever found in the years described in the book. Things have changed since the book ended.
Yeah, as they do, life goes on. Is there in the half a minute or so we have left? Is there one book above any other that you just held on to and read to death and completely dog-eared?
Oh my goodness! You know, it would be nice to give you one, but I tell people that I became a professor and scholar of literature because one was never enough.
Uh-huh.
So I tell people that I don't have a favorite book because reading is what I'm into. And I always tell my students the first few days of class, I even care about bad books, because the point is not good. The point is just reading.
All right. That's great. Yeah. Yeah. Even bad books matter. Oh, that's excellent. The book is called Floating in a Most Peculiar Way. It's a memoir, a story that is quite moving, quite fascinating, quite jarring at times, as Louis Chudasokyi tells his story. Louis, thank you so much for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange today.
Thank you for having me and for being interested in my story.
And thank you for listening to today's Jefferson Exchange. For senior producer Angela Decker and all of us at JPR News, have a great day.